My name is Dixie Hansen, and I'm coming from a preschool background. Although my education was in secondary English, but it's in preschool actually that I learned about teaching and about children, and that's where, and what I've been trying to do is apply some of that, what my teaching that I learned in preschool, to the church in terms of Sunday school. So beginning with looking at the cognitive development of children leads to the moral development and also the faith development, and how does that all fit together, and what implications then does that have for the way we teach in Sunday school. The first session I did was on Sunday school, why do we need it? And the point of that was to, if we have a Sunday school, if every church should say, why do we have it? And make it real clear why it's there, and then try to structure the program that it meets those purposes and goals. The purposes and goals that we came up with at our church are to support the education in the home, seeing that the home and the church services is the primary mode of education, and then the Sunday school being a part of that. To build relationships, to acquaint children with their biblical heritage, and to relate their lives to God. And that's just kind of the purposes and goals of our Sunday school program. Now tonight, I wanted to look at, okay, if we know what we want to do, we have to know who the children are that we're teaching and try to understand how they learn, so that then we can structure what kind of things we're going to do in order for the kinds of things that we want to happen. There are two, if you think of the way babies learn, there are two models that you can look at for how children learn. The first one is how they learn to eat. And they start out with milk, mother's milk, and then you mash the food up and you give them a banana, and then you cut it into little pieces and you feed that. And you're feeding one thing at a time until they get used to it, and so on until they're on a full diet of. If you apply that same method to language, you would begin by speaking only to the child in sounds. Then you would start just talking in one word, expanding to two-word sentences, and so on, until the child was speaking in paragraphs, and so on. Well, we don't teach language that way, and there's a good reason for it, because children don't cognitively learn that way. And yet, part of the reason that I have found preschool to be so much more exciting educationally is that it's coming from the teaching of children from what's called a constructive mode, as opposed to the behaviorist, which is you find often in elementary schools. What they do is they take a body of knowledge, cut it up into little pieces, and try to spoon feed it to the child in terms of reading. You know, okay, we're going to learn all the alphabet, the names of the alphabet, then the sounds of the alphabet. Then we're going to put it together. And that's kind of the way they're teaching reading. And I maintain that if we taught language, speaking, the same way we teach writing, we would have a lot of speech impediments in our world. The other method of teaching, and fortunately the schools are getting away from that, but the tradition in the elementary schools has pretty much been that we're going to teach this body of knowledge, and we're going to cut it up in little pieces and feed it to the child one at a time. But if you think of the way a child learns language, they experience the total language right away. You talk to the child, You say the words, they not only the words that you talk to them, but they hear the language that people are talking to each other. What they do then is they take in the sounds that they make are sounds that they've picked up and have constructed inside to reflect back. The word, nobody teaches a child to say one word for a meaning. They pick out of that sentence that you just told them, do you want a ball? They pick out of there the most important word, and then they, as they're able to physically, then they repeat that word. So the child takes in the experience and out of that constructs from all the different experiences they have with that particular thing, constructs their own knowledge, and then out of then it comes out in the way that they're able to produce it. And I think that's a real important idea in terms of setting up educational experiences for children. And I'll give you an example of how that's done in a preschool setting. One of the things that you know, children learn is color mixing. And it's a one way of teaching it, of course, is to teach them one color at a time and then put the colors together, and you can, and I suppose you could have a red card and a blue card, and red plus this equals green, and you could have them rotely memorize it, but of course it wouldn't stick with them. What of course we want to do in the preschool is have them experience that. Well, they do experience it at the art table. We do put finger painting out. You put two colors and they put them together. And they do experience it at the art, the easel. And you'll find children at a particular point discovering that colors mix. But the thing is, it's not, paint is not very clear colors. When you mix it in different quantities, you get different colors. So what we wanted to do is we wanted to set up an experience at the science table for children to discover color mixing. Well, we have baby food jars, which we use a lot. So we began by just putting red food coloring and blue food coloring out. And of course, if you do that, they're going to just pour. We added eyedroppers because they were just pouring it, not discovering. They were just into the idea of pouring it. We added eyedroppers to fill up another baby food jar, but that was too much. The eyedropper took too long. They didn't stay with it. What finally worked, and again, all these experiences of success and failure are important. Because that again is teaching. It's setting it up, seeing what a child, you have in your mind kind of what you want the child to learn from the experience. You set it up and you see, okay, the children are into pouring. They're not into seeing the colors. Then somebody gave us some clear plastic tubes. Very, you know, little tubes that you test tube kind of things. Then the child could take the eyedropper with the red food color and drop it in, and the eyedropper of the blue and drop it in, an instant color change. It was the first time we said, they noticed the color change. I mean, it was a discovery experience for them, but it was the experience was set up so that they could discover it. But you had to think of the way that the experience was set up in order for that to happen. An example of children not just playing, you know, but I don't want them to just play, is what we get, you know, I want them to learn. Another example was the calendar. If you teach the calendar, you find out how complicated time is. I mean, you're talking about days, you're talking about months, you're talking about numbers of days of the month. And the traditional way of teaching the calendar in a preschool or an elementary setting is to have a blank chart and you fill up one by one the days as they go along, and you usually have snowmen for January. In California, whether it snows or not, you do that. And I was never satisfied. You know, I figured I should do something with it because they were going to get the calendar in kindergarten, and there's a lot there, so at least expose it to them. But got no. It turned out into a boring exercise. You lost the kids every time you did it. You lost the teacher because the teacher was getting bored with it. The next thing I tried was taking a straw, and for every day, putting a straw in, and then putting it in clumps of 10. Look at how many days we have, you know, as the clumps get bigger. Well, that didn't relate either. Finally, after 10 years of teaching this year, I discovered by watching my daughter, she crossed the days out on her calendar at home, crossed them out one at a time. A simple thing, but for preschool children, that made all the difference in the world. They no longer had to know the numbers and put them up one at a time. They couldn't, even if they knew 1 through 10, they didn't know 1 through 30. And they could see if their birthday was down here and we had 5 days, they could see how many days they were to that birthday or that special day that we were coming to. By the end of the year, we put stickers on Mondays because that was the first day we came back, so they could see the pattern of the days. Wednesdays and Thursday we had lunch, so we put stickers that indicated lunch, and so on. But the point is that you're trying to structure an experience in which children will learn. And in teaching, as I said, it's a trial and error. It's watching to see how the children react, what do they bring, what are they constructing, and how you can change it so that other things will happen. That's just by way of kind of an overall arching idea of how we, and it's not just children. Children don't just learn by constructing that. We all do. You read a book. The things that relate to your experience are the ones that you add on to what you know. My husband is an Indian scholar, and when I had when he was over in India the year I was a senior in college, and he wrote letters telling me about India. But at that point, it was very hard for me to pick up a book about India. It was just too foreign. There are too many foreign kinds of things to my experience. Yet after I had been there, and through letters and through slides that he brought back, I found myself learning quite a bit even before I got there. And when I came back, I could pick up a book and then plug in. You have to have some kind of experience to incorporate your new knowledge into. Okay, now, looking at the cognitive development and how that happens with children. Sensory motor stage is the first 2 years where they learn everything by feeling. Everything goes in the mouth. It's touching. It's feeling. It's, you know, if you've seen a two-year-old in a house, you know what they do. They want to touch everything. This is how they learn. The pre-op, and I'm using Piaget's stages of development here. The pre-operational child is about 2 to 7, and in that age, symbolic play begins. That's where you have the a lot of dramatic play and the dramatic in the housekeeping corner begin to acting out roles, and if they don't have it, the real object, they use it for a whatever they want to use it for, the symbolic play. But what's characteristic about that age is that they can only concentrate on one thing at a time. And the Piagetian tasks that you have to, and if you have young children, it's fun to try this. Taking two clumps of Play-Doh, or maybe another, an easier something, maybe, well, taking two clumps of Play-Doh, making sure that they are the same, and you ask the child, are these, is this the same amount, or is there more in one or more in the other? And after the child says, yes, they're exactly the same amount, then you go ahead and you take one clump and you roll it out so it's longer. And you ask the child, now, is it the same amount, or does this have more, or does this have more? A child in the preoperational stage will say the longer one, usually will say the longer one has more. And you can do it as many times as you want, and they'll say the same thing. When they start getting into the next thinking level, concrete operations, they'll recognize that it's the same in both because you didn't take any away or you didn't add any. So they're both the same. But characteristic of that earlier stage is that if you change the shape, they can only concentrate on the shape or the quantity. They cannot concentrate on both the shape and the quantity at the same time. That becomes significant again when you're teaching a story. What does that mean for a story? They see one page at a time. They don't see the continual line of the total story. They see one page and it triggers thoughts. And they can, after a number of readings, they'll be able to tell you what happens on each page, but the total line of the story doesn't come until they go from that pre-operational stage to the concrete stage. In the concrete, they are able to, and what's interesting is to have to do the task with some children who are in the pre-operational and they say, no, there is more, and then you have another child there and say, no, it's the same because nothing happened to it. You can do the same thing with pennies. You take 10 pennies and line them up in a row and you put them right opposite each other and then you spread out one line. And they can count them. They can actually count them. But they'll still tell you there's more in the line that's longer. And that's that's because of their thinking process at that point. So the concrete operations, which then happens around 6 or 7, you find children in the preschool at 5, 6, some of them are going through the transition stage where they're not sure. You know, and they'll say, no, I think it's the same, and then you'll say, why is that? And they're not sure. So there's a transition. Formal operations starts at 11 to 14, or is it through about 11, 14, that's where your abstract thought starts. And you are capable of complex problem reasoning. Okay, that's the cognitive, the thinking. Studies have also been done on moral development. And there's stages in that too in terms of what's wrong, how children see right and wrong. Before 2, they just follow their impulses, you know, and then they learn what the word no means in your teachings, but there's no thought process that goes into that. From 2 to 4, their moral decisions are based on reward and punishment, the consequences. And that's, you know, if somebody is going to do something to me, to either reward me for doing it or to punish me. From ages 5 to 10, children conform to an acceptable standard of good role models. What are the rules? they'll go by the rules that somebody has given them to tell them this is what's right and this is what's wrong. I was going to tell a story about her, but I'm not sure since communion was an example, I think, of Karna's seven. And she thought she knew what the rules were, but here she's invited up and is unsure about that. And so it created a disequilibrium there in terms of, and with this age, they want to know what's right. And they know what's right, and they want to let you know what's right, and then everything's fine. And the reason they know is because somebody's told them that these are the rules. Ages 10 to 14, they're legalistic in following their internal moral code. They do what the authority figures say. And then by the time the adult moral code should be, if it is developed, is an internalized set of moral principles. How will it affect others? What are the consequences if everyone else were to do this? And what does God say? Now, how do you help children develop a moral code? Number one, you build self-esteem. And I think that's something that's, capital one. One of the things that I've noticed in terms of the different experiences I've had with people with problems, social problems, whatever, then probably the number one problem is that these people don't have self-esteem. And even though we know that that's true, many times our actions in terms of dealing with children or with other people too does not enhance self-esteem. And it's almost like whatever you do, make sure that you're building up the child's self-esteem. Number two, establish strong, biblically based moral code for the family. This is something that I have become much more conscious of, and I think we all need to become more conscious of in our society, where there doesn't seem to be any real strong moral code, and not only there isn't any strong moral code in society, but there's a lot of messages that are negative coming through. And that was one of the things I decided when my son was young in terms of guns. Now, all children play with guns, but I decided at that point that I was going to make a strong statement that I didn't like guns and I didn't want them in my house. So I wasn't going to buy him guns. He went down to the neighborhood and played with the kids down there, and he used guns in terms of making his own. But that's also something that we've done at the preschool, is say, we just don't like guns. And can you make something that will help people instead of hurt people? And they always say, well, we don't mean, it's just pretend and all that. And at some point in our society, probably that would have been, and there's a controversy too, whether that should be acceptable at play and so on. But for myself, it was like, the society was giving very many mixed messages, and I wanted to make a strong statement in contrast to that. And I think that's something that we need to do. Another thing that I've felt fairly strongly about in terms of my family is that once you make a commitment, you follow through. You don't, well, if you feel like it, you can do it, or if you don't feel like it, that's okay, too. I think that, anyway, the moral code that's established in the home is an important one. Number three, encourage thinking about right and wrong. What would you do if, and they give an example such as, what would you do if your family didn't have enough money and the neighbors had plenty but wouldn't give you any? What would you do? Now, there are three possible answers here that tell you, well, lots more possible answers, but here are three answers that would tell you where a child is in terms of their moral code. The first one, I wouldn't steal because I might get caught. You're at the reward and punishment place. Or the second one, because my mommy says stealing is wrong. I wouldn't steal because my mommy says stealing is wrong, based on the authority figure. And the third one, because God says thou shalt not steal, and because I want to be trusted, is finally getting into the developing an internal moral code. Another way to help children develop a moral code is to encourage children to make decisions and take responsibility for them. The consequences, letting children fail, letting them experience that failure, and then talking about why it did fail. We have a tendency to try to shield children a lot from consequences. And then finally, faith development. There's a book, Will Our Children Have Faith, by John Westerhoff, and he's often quoted in terms of the stages of faith development. A couple things that he says about faith. First, faith is deeply personal, dynamic, and ultimate. Religion is faith's expression, and religion is a means, not an end. Faith is the end. For faith, the most significant and fundamental form of learning is experience. Later, a person may image the experience and then finally conceptualize it. But experiences, and that goes back to how we all learn. If our children are to have Christian faith, the life they experience in the church must be a distinctive expression of the church faith story. Again, the experience, they're going to get the experience, their experiential faith from what happens in the church. And it's got to be a clear message. What is important is not what we give to another, but what we share. And that's, in terms of teaching, I think that's an important distinction to make. That you get from the child as well as give to the child. There's a and between each other. It's a give and take. He has four stages of faith. The first one being the experienced faith, where children experience trust, love, and acceptance, and it's through interactions with others that they learn this. They come to the world with a sense of wonder, and this can be nurtured in that experienced faith stage. The second stage is affiliate, when you belong to the community with a clear sense of identity. Just as you belong to your family and there's an identity with your family, there's also a church family that you belong to. And it's crucial in this stage that there's a sense that we are wanted, needed, accepted, and important to the community. That you're a part of the community and not a set aside from it. The other thing he says in the affiliate faith is that participation in the arts is essential. Part of this idea of the fact that we learn through experience, the arts, drama, music, dance, sculpture, painting, storytelling, those are experiences before the acts of thinking. Those are going to kind of the soul of a person. They're expressions of that. And so it's important that children experience a lot of the arts. The third stage of faith is a searching faith, and that's where you'll find your teenagers, your college age. Not only, but that's if people are following their development. And here the religion of the head becomes equally important as the religion of the heart. It's a time of experimentation. It's a time of testing the tradition. What's happening here is you have accepted the faith of your parents, and it needs to be tested in order for you to get to the final stage, which is the owned faith. So although, which tells you that just because teenagers, college-age young people are not within the church, or they go to other churches, does not necessarily mean that they've abandoned the faith, but it's more that they're testing, finding where their particular faith experience has led them. And that's a necessary stage in order to get to that final owned faith. Okay, there's a, what does this mean in terms of a Sunday school? Or a church education? This parish teacher annual that's put out by Augsburg is a good summary of age level characteristics. And what I've done is just summarize some of the things that they say in there in terms of the characteristics of children. What this means for teaching, and what the goals of teachers are going to be. Characteristics of the preschool is that they're egocentric, meaning that they relate everything through their personal experience. Friends are momentary. The friend is the one I'm playing with right now. I don't have any best friend kind of thing. They're developing initiative. They're influenced by moods and actions of parents and other primary adults. And they have a sense of belonging to a group that likes God. So again, we talked about this is their experiential age where they're experiencing the church through the people that they meet, the atmosphere that's created. In terms of Bible stories, what are they seeing? They're seeing a slideshow. They're seeing one frame at a time, and their fantasy fills in the gaps and integrates bits and pieces into a complete picture. When you read a story to preschoolers, you know, they'll just stop you and interject something that reminds them they see an animal and they remember seeing something, seeing it somewhere else. Those kinds of things happen all the time. Symbolic language is taken literally. And they accept whatever they're told about God. So it's important at this age to choose stories that show God's love. The other thing that we found is that to stick pretty much with stories about Jesus. We did the Exodus in our Sunday school program one year, and the preschoolers, we had a storyteller tell the story of Exodus and Moses. And the preschoolers were very confused when you went back from Moses to Jesus. It was like that, you know, that centering on one thing. That, you know, who is Jesus and who is Moses? And that didn't work at all. So we've discovered you stay with Jesus stories. And just the goals of a teacher at that age, building self-concept, providing group prayers, singing songs of praise and thanksgiving, sharing faith on a feeling level, and modeling faith. Just the whole creating the atmosphere of worship and being together and sharing. Grades 1 through 3, the peer group impact is increasing here. The social skills are developing. The self-worth is still very fragile. And they are beginning to classify. The roots of social prejudice are there. And I think the acceptance of people that are different. You'll find children in grades 1 through 3 are I don't like that person because there's something different about them. When they see a story, it's like a motion picture. they understand the narrative, but not the hidden meanings, or can't pick out a moral. They can tell you the whole story and see how it works together, but they can't pick out a moral. They understand cause and effect, but can't generalize about the meaning. God is thought of in human terms. God and Jesus are interchangeable. Messiah, Lord, Savior are not meaningful to them. Literal interpretation of they have a literal interpretation of stories, and the sex role identification in stories is important. Who they can pick out, because they are identifying with their sexual models. Images of God become building blocks for later ideas. So the goals of the teachers then give a strong emotional support, encourage participation in group worship. This is a time when you can begin to start looking at the liturgy, bringing in the hymn book, letting them see, verbalizing some of the things that are happening. They're beginning to read, so helping them to participate in the language part of the church service. But be concerned about the impact of the story as a whole and lead children to stories that let heroes' contagious enthusiasm inspire Christian ideals and values. They identify with the heroes strongly, so want to make sure that the messages come through. Grades 4 through 6, there's strong needs for accomplishment. Athletic skills are important. Their main worries are school and homework. Popularity depends on the boys being strong, positive, and aggressive, girls good looks, friendly, and good sportsmanship, and I'm afraid it's still true even if we're trying to break down stereotypes. The social group norms are important. They're becoming aware of evil and injustice. And there's concrete thinking. They're better at classifying and integrating factual information. So they're beginning the abstract thinking processes. Beginning to see discrepancies in their view of God. They're coming out with that God is, as a parent, has become almost literally a parent. Well, those discrepancies are coming into play here now. So the goals of the teacher is to affirm skill development. You see the self-concept building all through here. Be tuned to students' achievements and school experiences. Help students think critically about former religious notions. And provide safe and secure an environment to explore questions and doubts. And then you get into the junior high, where they can comprehend Christian truths. Their awkwardness, their earlier human images of God are replaced. Redefined religious beliefs, and group pressures are great. Bible stories, understand they're understanding God as a spirit now. They're able to understand that. They look for inconsistencies. They're almost looking for things that are wrong, and they're trying to reconcile religion and science. That's why it's real dangerous to build your religion on any kind of scientific, because it won't hold up under that kind of scrutiny. They deal with problems in the abstract, and their own faith is beginning. Could be. Seems early, but... So the goals of the teacher are to show how Christian faith can give meaning and purpose to changing and confusing lives, help give logical consistency to Christian teaching, help understand sexuality from a Christian perspective, and build an effective support group. And I think I'll stop there. They also give characteristics for high school and young adult. But, I should probably, let's see. Just a couple of books I wanted to tell you. The Bible, A Child's Playground. If you remember, I talked about how children learn language and how they take in, they're exposed to the whole experience and they take in parts of it. Roger and Gertrude Goebel, I guess that's how you pronounce it. Premise here is that children should be exposed to the Bible in they object to sometimes the way that we reduce Bible stories to such a simple level that a lot of the meaning is lost. And their point is that we should expose the children to the Bible in such a way that they can then also take from the stories what they're ready to take from. Read the Bible, read the stories from the Bible, and not try to simplify everything down so much. Let them, and I think that works. I think that's a good point to make, because I think we sometimes do that. I've read an article in terms of hymns too. Sometimes we just teach them the children's songs, and some of them are fine, but we can also teach them hymns, and it gives a sense of power to children for them to learn hymns that adults are singing. And so what if they don't understand every word in it? They can take out of that what it means. And I think, you know, that's taking that with, you have to be careful with that too. I wouldn't read any Bible story from the Bible and expect a child to just take meaning from it. But I think that's a point worth making. The other two books that I think are very good are two books by Richard Simon Hansen. One is The Sunday Church School Teacher, which he, and Worshiping with a Child. And one of the things that he does in Worshiping with a Child is he uses the Lord's Prayer and gives suggestions on a couple different levels of introducing the Lord's Prayer at a child's level. One of the other things he does is suggests that we use the Psalms to, there are passages in the Psalms that help give expression to ideas that children will already have. And one of them is Psalm 139 he uses, that I'll read and see if you can hear a child, see a child getting something from. Where could I hide from you? If I climb to the sky, you are there. If I lie in the grave, you are there too. If I could fly on the wings of the morning and travel beyond the sea, even there you would lead me. Your hand would hold me. If I say, let the darkness cover me, let the lights go out and let it be night, the darkness is not dark to you. To you, the night is as bright as day as the day. Obviously, that's in a modern translation, but to pick out passages in Psalms that speak to this, to the immensity of God and the wonder of God. But he also takes the Lord's Prayer, and I'll just give you a sample of a way that he would introduce the Lord's Prayer to, say, some children between the ages of 6 and 9. My child, I want you to know where you come from. You didn't just come from mommy's tummy or from your mommy's and daddy's love. That love is an old love which comes from the one who makes all things and gives all things. That one is father and mother of all. And that one is so big that we think of the sky reaching beyond the sun and all stars, and we say, our Father who art in heaven. That one is special, so we use a special word. That word is holy and hallowed, and so we say, hallowed be thy name. That one is king and queen in the kingdom which is greater than all. And in that kingdom, life and all good things keep coming, coming, coming. That is why we pray, thy kingdom come. You know, and he goes on in that way of interpreting, but still giving them. I mean, the Lord's Prayer isn't an adult prayer, but trying to relate that to a child's experience. Now I covered a lot, and I should... Yeah, what kinds of questions? This is John Westerhoff. Support searching faith by spiritual life retreats, short-term interest groups, small intensive study groups, and a variety of interactions in and outside the church between adolescents and adults with own faith. Having them have dialogue with other people, sharing faith stories. And I think that's an important thing that we need to be doing with children, is having people share what kinds of struggles they went through and where they ended up and why, and those kinds of things is what he suggests. I think it's important for us to realize that searching faith is an important stage. That if you stay at that affiliate, I belong to the Lutheran Church because my parents belong to the Lutheran Church, and therefore I do. It's not a very alive faith. I heard the statement once that God has no grandchildren. Richard Simon Hansen also suggests that you can help children give expression to their faith that they already have. What is God like? Through questions like, what is God like? What do you know about God? Of all good things you can think of, what things are best? Of all the strongest things you can think of, what's the strongest? Of all things you can trust? Just questions like that, having the child answer questions like that and then listen. No right or wrong answers, but it gives you an idea of where the child is at in terms of their faith. The other thing he talks about is what can children teach adults? And one of the things that children can teach adults, he says, is that faith is not a matter of what one knows or understands. As we get older, we say, okay, now explain that to me. Okay, now I understand. And now I believe. Well, faith is not a matter of understanding. If you understand something, that means it's smaller than your mind. So faith really is believing something that's greater than your mind. Well, a child is a perfect example, and I think what Jesus was probably talking about when he said, you must become like a child. A child comes into the world smaller than everything, knows what it's like to trust and believe something without understanding it. And what is the question that they ask? Why? And Richard Simon Hansen says, all of those whys eventually lead to God. And he speculates that it must give a child satisfaction to find out that this big, strong adult that knows everything can answer all his why questions. And that for us to, as adults, to let him know that that's fine, because it's the why. Yeah. But also, you know, not saying it and then also living it. I think, because we are tempted a lot. No, he is 12, we'll have to pay the adult rate, you know. It's easy when their birthday is last week to say, well, he's still 11. I mean, it's all those little kinds of, and the children know that what you're doing. You know, it's all those little things, I think, that make the difference in terms of the messages. Because it's not only saying it, but it's making those right decisions in those when it's real easy not to.